Thanks for tuning in to Go to Market Radio. Every episode, we'll be getting up close and personal with GTM leaders and experts so you can learn the secrets of their success. Looking to take your team to the next level? You're in the right place. Every week, we're bringing you an exclusive podcast from the Alliance Archives that highlights a core aspect of GTM. If you love this episode as much as we do, make sure to subscribe and we'll keep you up to date with all the latest on our channel.
CMO Diaries is back with a new regular guest, Andrea Linehan. Andrea is featured on our sister show, CMO Convo, as the CMO of the fintech company Currency Fair. But following their recent merger with Assembly Payments, she's here representing the new combined brand, Zai. And funnily enough, that's the topic we're discussing today. How has Andrea been approaching developing a new brand from the merger, with advice and insights for others doing the same? Hi, Andrea. Welcome back to CMO Diaries. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Will. Good to see you this year.
Yes. First episode of 2022. And it's a good one to be talking about in 2022, because it requires a bit of rethinking about how we do marketing, I think, because what we're talking about today is we're talking about the 95-5 ratio. And we'll go into what that means in a little bit. But basically, it's a way of rethinking how we talk about prospects, how we talk about who your marketing is aimed at, how you set like long-term marketing goals. So before we get into what it means to actually do all that rethinking, let's break into what is the 95-5 ratio. It's to do with like who is ready to buy, basically. But do you want to expand a bit more on what that means?
Yeah, exactly. And look, I might start off with how this is incredibly topical for me and my team at the moment. So I know we talked about before, we've recently gone through a major merger. And as part with a company in Australia, and I actually spent a few weeks in Australia before Christmas, meeting with the teams, just getting to grips with the market there, and really start to work on the strategy for 2022 for us to expand into multiple markets now this year. We have a pretty ambitious and aggressive expansion plan. So I really had to think, right, how are we going to really hit the ground running and be as effective as possible with the budget that we had? And so I was doing research, just trying to understand, you know, what were the market dynamics at the moment? What had COVID done to behavior and intent, and with people working from home, what did that mean from capturing data and all of that stuff? So what had changed that I'm going to need to address in my strategy? And you know, we'd all heard about that 60-40 rule, and we'd all kind of lived by it. But I was quite shocked to come across a super article by Peter Weinberg and John Lombardo, who would have written about the 95-5 rule, which basically says that 95% of your market, of your buyers, are not in market, meaning that they're not out there searching for your product or solution or a similar product or solution, because they just haven't either been made aware of the pain point that they have, they're not even sure that it's a pain, or they've just accepted that there isn't a solution out there. So, you know, we go to our boards and leadership teams and we say, look, here's the size of the market, we've sized the market, here's the opportunity, isn't it fabulous? But actually, there's only 5% of that market that are willing to have a very active conversation with you right now. Now, I should caveat, obviously, this is very specific to B2B. And in particular, I think it's more prevalent for those higher value projects and more strategic projects than the opposite end of the spectrum. But it was a major eye-opener. And I know you and I have chatted a bit about this, because you came across similar research, but with a slightly different metric.
I did, yes. I've seen a few in a few different places where it was 97% of your prospects aren't ready to buy. But then I've also seen it going all the way up to like 92%. But at the end of the day, what it is that the vast majority of your prospects and target audience aren't ready to buy, and that's going to take a real rethinking of like how you target your marketing. Because I think for a lot of B2B marketers, the focus is on pushing people through the funnel, when in actual fact, the vast majority of your audience, they're not ready to even enter the funnel to begin with. Like the funnel's not even on their radar. So it requires a bit of rethinking about where you're focusing your marketing, where you're targeting your marketing, because the advice that we've gotten from these articles, from this research and from our discussions is that you need to focus on the majority rather than minority. That small percentage, your job's already done as a marketer. They know who you are. They're pretty much sales qualified at that point. The focus is on building your reputation, I suppose, building your presence, but putting yourself top of mind amongst that large chunk of people that they're not ready to buy, but they could be ready to buy in the future.
Like, exactly. And it's about nurturing all of those out of market buyers. So that, you know, 92, 95, 97%, it's making sure that you're nurturing them before they move in market and not waiting until they get to that awareness stage and go down through that lovely designed, supposedly linear funnel. We got to be thinking about impacting future sales in future buying situations. And the only way to increase the probability of that is to make sure, exactly to your point, that your reputation, your brand, your expertise comes to mind immediately the moment that buyer goes in market. And actually, you know, looking at the different strategies, right, there's two very different approaches that will be required then to nurture those out-of-market buyers, but at the same time be nurturing your in-market buyers, because just because they're in market doesn't mean that they're going to automatically buy from you. There is still a mountain of work to go through getting shortlisted in the first place and then ultimately winning the contract. So I've split those up into account-based marketing and inbound marketing. And when, you know, looking at both of those strategies, account-based marketing is far more effective for that 5% of in-market buyers, and allows you to identify who is in market and who's not. But then for everybody else, that's where the good old inbound marketing strategy comes to play, because it is all about thought leaderships and reputation and, you know, developing awareness around problems and pain points and opportunities. And it's a much longer tail approach. But it's actually the real smarts are in how do you get both of those strategies working in tandem and being really effective, because at the end of the day, it's going to mean allocating your resources, both budget and people, to keeping both of those strategies going at the same time. But ultimately, it is a really smart combination.
Definitely, because with ABM, you're sort of looking at the now. You're looking at the immediate needs of people who are ready for your product right there. Whereas, like with the inbound marketing approach, with this targeting the 95 percentile, you're planting seeds, basically. You're thinking about the long-term development of the company. You're setting up sales prospects that they might not happen for months, they might not even happen for years, but it means that when they do become ready to become your customers, you'll be the first person they think of. That's the ultimate goal, from what I understood from my research. I don't know if that's what you're thinking. Are you thinking in like years long sales cycles? Are you setting things up for like months in advance? Like,
it has to be both, right? Because we have, at the end of the day, we're working off quarterly and annual targets, really aggressive ones. And if you don't set the foundation for the following year, you're just going to spend every single year chasing your tail, trying to meet near-term, short-term targets all the time. And that's just not scalable. That's what leads to burnout. That's what leads to exhausting budgets and not getting any kind of feasible return on investment for what you're doing with your marketing budget. So they'll always both be alive. I think it'll really depend as the inbound marketing strategy starts to mature and we start to see a natural flow of business coming through that, which will probably take 12, 18 months to really start to see some return on that. We'll only know then, once that return is coming about, whether how much we can pull back on our account-based marketing approach. So it's a little bit of a wait and see, but we're set up now for that. Having the both strategies underway at the same time means that we've diversified our approach enough that if for any reason one isn't successful, we do have the other, because it is too easy to put all your eggs in one basket. Because it's easy to call these things, this is account based marketing and this inbound marketing, you and I both know, as well as all the marketing listeners, it is incredibly complex what goes in, all this, the strings that need to be pulled and the orchestration of effort that need to go into making one of those strategies successful. So to have two of them going in tandem, it is going to be a serious orchestration play.
Orchestration is definitely right. Because I imagine having these two strategies running in tandem, it's not just going to be difficult for the marketing department to get their heads around. You've also got to get aligned with other departments as well. And like, I don't know how things are in your organization, but I can imagine a lot of our CMO listeners who are listening are thinking, oh my God, they want us to go to our CROs. They want us to go to our heads of sales and say, we're going to take the foot off the gas of lead gen for a little bit. We're going to focus on stuff that might not even happen for years and years. And I can imagine they're like, no, we need those leads now. Was that something that you had to get over with setting up this approach, or was it a fairly like natural way of like moving into things?
Well, one of the ways I had to sell this internally was actually refer to it as account-based experience. Now, not something I coined, and I can't think of the guy's name who used it, but something recently. And it's about the evolution of account-based marketing to be account-based experience, because actually for that to be a really effective strategy, a long-term strategy that really builds business value, it needs marketing, sales, account management, customer experience, everybody who's involved in the customer journey end to end in a very front-facing manner needs to be wholly aligned on it. It has to be that cradle to grave, or if you're so lucky, cradle to infinity planning that goes into it. And the problem with account-based marketing, as the name is, it has marketing in the name. So then that's the marketing people's job. So if you remove the word marketing, put in an experience, it then becomes a much more inclusive strategy. So that's what we're doing at Zai, is exactly that. And look, I'm very fortunate. We have a super sales and account management customer experience team. They're innovative. They're excited about ways to do it, about cooperation. So I'm pushing an open door anyway, but I know that's not always the case in a lot of companies. But I preempted or got ready in case there was any pushback on the account-based marketing approach to just rebrand it, do what we do best as marketing, is position something based on what we know our target market, how they need to consume it or understand it.
So if you don't mind, Andrea, I'm going to shamelessly plug our other show, because we did actually discuss ABX on that. If anyone's interested in account-based experience, check out the Forget ABM, You Should Be Thinking About ABX show, episode with John Miller on CMO Convo.
That's probably where I picked it up with.
It could be. Like you have appeared on the show. I know you're a fan. But going back to the practicalities of setting up these two approaches that work in tandem, how do they work in tandem? Because you talked about sort of like having the long-term inbound feeding into the ABM. Like, do you have like a system in place, or is that something that will happen when you cross that river kind of thing?
No, we have a very robust system in place. And look, it's thanks to HubSpot. I am a major evangelist of HubSpot and the capabilities it gives you. So, you know, we're able to run both of those strategies congruently using HubSpot. Now we're integrated into Salesforce, and, you know, we've thankfully an all singing, all dancing marketing technology set up, but that's what allows us to do it. But it allows us to do it in a very scalable, automatable way, because if we weren't able to do that, if we weren't able to automate and be really process orientated in how we run both those strategies, it wouldn't be feasible. We would just be running around like headless chickens. It has to be, we do everything in sprints. We do everything in a very organized project management approach, and then have everything running through HubSpot. So it just allows for me in particular to be able to just take that eagle view approach on both of those strategies as they are happening, but for the teams to feel that they can easily skim in and out of both strategies and know actually that some of the efforts that are being put into one strategy are complementing the other, and trying to, wherever possible, making sure that we're getting bang for buck on any of our time or marketing budget, because that's how you're going to make your budgets work for you and sweat your resources as much as possible. And, you know, a marketing's team's major resource is obviously the budget that they have, and it can oftentimes be finite. So you got to make sure that you can get as much bang for your dollar as possible.
Let's talk about resources, because this kind of approach would require, for a lot of B2B organizations, a bit of reallocation of where their resources are going. So what types of inbound marketing are you focusing on? You mentioned thought leadership. What does that look like? Is it blog pieces? Is it art? Is it your standard like content marketing fare? Are you doing like more, I don't want to say creative approach, unusual approaches to building up like your presence amongst that 95% of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've gotten a specific that each one of the disciplines within their team, whether it is, you know, content marketing team, the design team, the digital team, the acquisition team, like everybody now is looking to their specialty and their expertise, and looking what account-based marketing means for their particular area. And there are tactics for around design, for instance, that you can use. And our senior designer, Seb, has already put a strategy together on how he can use account-based marketing or account-based experience and use it through design, so that we're really taking the strategy and going all the way with it. So that then is informing each of the individual roadmaps, sprint plans, and overall annual plan for each then of these different disciplines within the teams. And because everybody can see how it all, the red thread of it comes together, it makes it so much easier then for cross-collaboration for each of those. So that's definitely, we've been very fortunate. I'm very fortunate. I'm an incredibly talented, smart team. And, you know, I just need to give the seed of the idea and can say, look, here's going to be a strategy. And they just disperse and come back with even better and bigger ideas around how their particular area can contribute and participate in the strategy and how to deliver it. And, you know, design being one particular element of it, even from a PR perspective, you know, there's us be, you know, it's not just be us being a thought leader in fintech, for instance. You know, we're being very specific around the areas that we want to build thought leadership in, because otherwise you end up skimming the surface. Whereas to be a true thought leader, you need to have deep knowledge and expertise, and for it to be consistent. So eventually, you know, thought leadership obviously feeds into your building your brand and your reputation. And with that, it has to be consistency and familiarity, you know. And we know that when somebody needs to be served, what is it, 26, 27 times on an ad before it even resonates, you know, that's the same with thought leaderships around a particular topic. You know, so if Zai wants to have a bona fide association with a topic, we're going to have to be delivering those insights and opinions for a significant amount of time before it really lands and sits with someone that, okay, if I want to know something about that topic, I know Zai's blog is the place to go. You know, it's no different than what HubSpot did. It took them a long time to become the go-to place for marketers to get everything marketing strategy and execution related. So it takes time.
Definitely. And it's doing it in a way that's memorable as well, because there are so many competitors out there. You've got to stand out with the way you present your thought leadership activities and any kind of inbound marketing. Like, it was interesting that you mentioned design there, because brand has got to be a big part of sort of these long-term projects, because you want it to be top of mind when people are thinking about a certain subject. And the best way to do that is to have a strong, powerful brand. And we dove into a bit of branding, well, quite a lot of branding talk in our last episode. Do you want to expand on how the brand is setting you up to go with these kinds of activities, these kind of strategies?
Yeah, that definitely, even though we hadn't embarked on the account-based marketing or account-based experience strategy officially at that time, one thing we did know is in the sea of sameness that is fintechs and most tech companies these days, there was no way we were going to be cookie cutter in terms of our how we were going to go about shortlisting names even and colors. And, you know, there's a very typical uniform now that goes along with fintechs. You'd see them a mile away. So we were already making that decision last year. And as you know, we launched our brand Zai last November, and we're still very excited and thrilled to see that it does stand out. But, you know, the design element of it is only one part of it. It's also going to be how we're showing up in the digital world and elsewhere, what we're talking about, what we're saying, and how we're saying it. And this is the interesting thing around inbound, because obviously SEO is a major component of it, and the content marketing. And the interesting thing about SEO is because you're reliant on people searching for things, but everybody ends up in their own echo chamber and search for things that they're already familiar with or know about. So you're trying to, so then to position yourself as a thought leader, as someone who's coming up with newer ways of thinking, you're trying to have that combination of, okay, you want to be talking about things that are familiar to people enough that they're actually going to invest time to read about it and search for it. But you also then want to be layering it with additional insights or an opinion piece on it. And I actually think that's really what helps brands and companies stand apart as thought leaders or content through inbound or content marketing, is getting that combination right. And it's really hard. Like it really takes a lot of finesse. And, you know, we, our content marketing team are set up, thanks to our head of content marketing, in much more of a newsroom type setup. And it's all, you know, an editorial calendar. And we're really looking at the quality of content from that lens of that combination. But it takes a lot. It takes a lot of effort and smarts to go into that.
So you said you've got the head of content who's got the room set up. How much influence do you have as a CMO of the direction that the content takes? Do you trust them completely, or do you have like some kind of like weather eye on like how the content's going?
I absolutely trust them incredibly. Unfortunately for our head of content, me as a T-shaped marketer, I've come up the content and brand track. So just by virtue of the excitement I get of working on that particular area, because it was my bread and butter coming up through the ranks. So I do get very involved, but it's the enjoyment of it. But they've absolutely got full rein. And you know, my head of content comes from a media background, so has taught me a lot about how to approach the production of content and looking at a very different lens, because I would have been very focused on, you know, the technicality of it and, you know, what it is we're trying to achieve in terms of measuring SEO and things like that. And, you know, we've really now pushed the envelope on the entertainment part of our content. And I don't mean entertainment in a funny way, but in educational, interesting thought pieces. And we're only scratching the surface. You know, we're still a new enough brand, so we have a lot left to do. But that's definitely an example of how we're going about it.
And it's, yeah, as you say, it's a way of making things memorable as well, which is what you need for these kinds of long-term strategies. You need to be like an educational piece that is just bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, fact, fact, fact. That's not going to be sticking in your mind. You might remember the facts, but you won't remember where the facts are from, which is actually a problem we encountered when we were setting up this episode, because I couldn't actually remember where I found these figures for the 97.3% ratio. So that's got to be a better approach. Has got to be taking this sort of like entertainment way of informing people. Like, people remember things more if they've enjoyed it, if there was a bit of emotional connection to it, a bit of a serotonin boost in there. And that, again, is going to take a bit of rethinking from a lot of B2B brands, particularly in the SaaS space, where a lot of the marketing is very, very features driven. Is this kind of long-term approach possible in sort of that kind of space, in those kinds of like very fast-moving environments where product developments can change rapidly, change the product you're selling? Can you have those kinds of long-term goals, do you think, in those kinds of environments?
You absolutely can, because it's more important that people get that serotonin fix from the author, whether that's the, you know, they consider that being the brand or the company or the team that happens to be putting out this content, that it's a trust in their ability to produce quality, interesting insights that's, you know, based on bona fide research and, you know, opinions are based off experience in a particular area. So it means that whatever is the topic du jour, and as the market's moving really fast, they can trust that the author is able to move along with it. So I think that's probably the difference between people, you know, appreciating and enjoying a piece of content, but it's just a good one out of, you know, five only okay ones. It goes back to that consistency of quality, because people get exhausted by having to learn how to read somebody's content. And even something as simple as that, you know, knowing that they can come and you're following a consistent format, your way of discussing a topic or something else that's going on in the world, whether it's in the sector that we happen to be operating in, then it takes the effort, so that effort reward equation is more balanced in their favor, because that's what kicks in for your dopamine hit, because, you know, you're enjoying something. It hasn't involved a lot of effort. That's the adoption ratio as well. That's what happens with products and services. You know, the lower the effort and the higher the return on enjoyment, or just solving for something or reducing pain, the more likely people are going to come back for more. And the very same is true of content. That's definitely a formula that we, you know, we don't have an Excel sheet with it all written out, and this, like, you need to tick all of these boxes to achieve this, but my team know that inherently, and it's because they've come from journalistic backgrounds and storytelling backgrounds, that they know that it's so much more than the words on the page creating sentences.
excellent. So when it comes to sort of like distribution for this, for the content that you're putting out, for many, many years, B2B marketers have been told that it needs to be highly targeted. And that's sort of like where the ABM movement came out of. It's doing stuff that is very, very highly targeted. But if you're thinking about sort of like this mass market appeal, if you're talking about this 95%, you can't really be too targeted. You've got to do sort of like a mass appeal piece, don't you? Or can you do like highly, highly specific niche topics to appeal to these types of audiences?
You got to do both. You absolutely have to do both. And the big reason for this is the highly targeted approach does yield results. There is no doubt. But again, all that ends up happening is you just end up as a company or as a brand buying into that echo chamber effect and making assumptions about who's going to be interested in your content. So if you're not always pushing the envelope a bit and creating target lists that you want to go after and kind of say, you know what, let's make 10% of this list a bit of an outlier target. So they're not who we'd ordinarily go after, but let's just add in an extra 10% that's a little bit random, or it's organized randomness. And let's just see what engagement happens, if any. Because if you don't get into other people's peripheral vision, you know, they're never going to go looking for you. So you're only ever going to be then limiting your own market. And a way to make your market bigger is to create the market, create the interest. But you got to get in front of people first. And if they're not looking for you, you got to get in their line of sight. So that's potentially a way to do it. But it's also the cross corroboration of topic, or the cross pollination of topics, for instance, and finding really smart red threads that you can link where this target market over here or this market over here, you know, they're all about blockchain, for instance, and, you know, that's all they can consume right now. You know, so if we know that we can service that market, but our content, we just can't broach in there and really service them with what they're searching for at the moment. How do we find a red thread to get into their search results without just being completely random with what we're talking about? And actually, I'll give you a perfect example of how we're getting ourselves in front of newer audiences. So we sponsor a show. It's called The Innovation Show. It's a podcast. And someone I've known now for the last couple of years. And he mostly, his name is Aidan McCullen, and he mostly interviews authors. You know, it could be anything from, it might be someone who has authored around, you know, the future of blockchain, but it could also be around behavioral science and what that has meant for, you know, tribes, you know, across the Southern Hemisphere. And it's just these really interesting, thought-provoking books. And he, so the only red thread that goes through it is it talks about innovation in you know, not just in business, but in politics and in economies and in markets and in countries or with people and communities and all lots of different ways. So you've a ton of different, the audience then is really, really broad. So, you know, we sponsor that so we can at least get ourselves in front of these people who are looking and obviously really hungry for new, interesting information. So there are lots of ways that you can break out of, and I know I keep repeating the echo chamber bit, but breaking out of your own echo chamber. And that's one of the ways that we're doing it.
Awesome. Awesome. So that's all well and good. We're targeting the 95%. How do you know when someone is moved into the 5%? How do you know that that's happened? Like you mentioned, they're looking for you. Is it just them putting their hand up and saying, "Hey, I'm ready to buy"? Or is there some kind of other indicators there that you're ready to sort of move into an ABM approach with them?
Yeah, this is where I believe the awareness stage, consideration stage, decision stage, those typical stages that we're all familiar with. To me, that's when the 5% are active. Mm-hmm. You know, so that awareness stage and the buyer becomes, you know, aware that they have a problem or they see an opportunity and they begin to research about it because they're looking to more clearly name and frame and understand their problem or the opportunity. So they're searching for this particular content. So if they then come across our content that happens to define what that particular problem or opportunity is, and they download it or they engage in it or whatever it might be that we're able to identify them and mark that intent, there we have them. Immediately then we know, okay, they're in some kind of buying cycle. And then it's a little bit more, once you've identified them, it's a bit easier then to see them or watch them or help them and nurture them move along those other stages. So it's really the key bit is when they move from the in market, from the outer market to the in market piece. That's where you got to catch them, because to be honest, once they're out there researching, you know, if you don't make their short list of the ones that they want to research a bit further, you forget about it. Because people don't have the luxury of time to research incredibly deeply. They just want to move things along really quickly. They have to try and convince 2, 5, 10 people within their business to go along with it. It's a painful exercise. So people just want to get through it as quickly as possible. So you've a very short window to make sure that you're on that short list at the start of that journey.
And that's where having the memorable brand comes into play, definitely. Because if you're a memorable brand, you're more likely to appear on that shortlist that people might have. They might even realize they have in their head they have a shortlist for certain things, but they might have that shortlist.
And they do. This is where the human bias and behavior comes in. A lot of the times, you know, before that even final 3 companies or whatever are being put forward, generally a decision has already emotionally been made by a lot of people on the journey. And depending how stringent your procurement processes need to be, the emotional decision mightn't have as much influence, but in a lot of places it really does. And we know, you know, the old statistics, 80% of research is done online before they even get near contacting a company. So, you know, you need to make sure that you've satisfied all of their concerns, and not just that person's concerns, but the stakeholder of decision makers that are behind them, their concerns have been addressed. And really by the time they're getting in front of you, they just want to see the whites of your eyes and make sure is what you've said on paper or on digital tallies with what you're going to tell us verbally and in a live meeting.
Awesome. Awesome. So I bet there's quite a few of our listeners, particularly ones with maybe quite demanding CROs and CEOs who are thinking there must be a way to speed up the process of moving from the 95% to the 5%. Do you think there is a way to do that? Is there a way to sort of speed things up, or are we likely to sabotage the whole system if we're
You can't force people to move into markets. We know that. But what you can do is make problems and opportunities, make them aware of problems and opportunities, because they're only going to be prompted to move into buying if they realize that there's a need to. So writing content around problems that are out there that are very specific to their business. And because we know a lot of people will just get on with their job, and you know, they've the head down, and you know, they're hyper focused on what they're working on. And so many people complain that they don't have time to take a step back, look at the bigger picture, you know, investigate what's going on in their sector, both in their own country and globally. They don't have that time. But if you can solve for that by doing the heavy lifting of that research and alerting them to what's going on in their industry, all of a sudden there's a holy crap, this is happening. We need to make sure that we have such and such a solution in place. Otherwise, we're going to become uncompetitive, or you know, we're going to lose out on market share, whatever it might be that you're pointing out to them. For me, that's realistically the only way that you're going to influence them moving into market.
So that kind of positioning with those kind of, to position those kinds of like solutions, well, solutions to problems they don't even know they have to people. If they're not searching for it, how do you get those solutions in front of them? Does it require a bit of outbound marketing? Is it about some paid placements to get them in front of them? Like where do you get those kinds
of things? It's a mixture. And this is the other thing. It's that portfolio of efforts and activities that are going on and finding that sweet spot. Because it'll never just be one channel or one approach. It has to be all of these things working in tandem. And again, it goes back to that red thread piece. You know, if you're trying to get in front of people who are really not looking for you, and you're going to have to make assumptions. And, you know, like if the time and effort and budget to be able to actually interview customers to understand what they're actually searching for, then, you know, weave in those problems and potential opportunities into the things they are searching for. And that's how you get it on their radar. But it gets way too expensive to force it in front of them through outbound marketing. It's just not scalable. Right. There's much savvier ways to do it.
definitely. So I feel like we could talk about this all day, Andrea, but I think it might make sense for us to pick up on this conversation again maybe in a few months when you've had this this strategy running for a while, and we can talk about how it's developed over time. But for now, let's sort of sum everything up with sort of your golden rules for how to approach this 95-5 ratio, maybe in terms of, let's do a golden rule for aligning other departments, a golden rule for setting up the process, and the golden rule for what you should be considering when it comes to the inbound marketing.
First one, definitely around account-based marketing or account-based experience, the education bit. I know myself, whether it was my own team and the recent conversations I've had with our own sales team and account management team, introducing to them to the concept of it, but more importantly, what it can do for each of the teams meeting their targets and their goals for the year. That is like a light switch for buy-in. So you have to take the time to educate people on what it is, what it'll do, and the effort that will be involved to make it happen. Because once you have that, then you have cooperators rather than blockers. So that's definitely the first piece of it. The second one then for the setup, like I said before, we were a bit fortunate that we'd already been, a lot of the setup that we had done for our inbound marketing strategy pretty easily pivoted to suit an account-based experience or account-based marketing strategy also. But I would go nowhere without my marketing technology stack. And look, I definitely shout about using Asana for project managing all of these. And of course, HubSpot then for production distribution, for everything you could possibly need, just without a doubt. And then the third one was about the inbound, Will, was it?
Yeah.
On the inbound, yeah, just the, again, coming back to the content piece, it's trying to stand out from that sea of sameness. And, you know, it's easier said than done. And people don't bother to do it because actually it takes a bit more effort and time. But if you hire writers, storytellers and, you know, former journalists, they just inherently and naturally look at research and then what they put down on paper in a very different way than I think maybe more formulaic content writers who probably put a bit more emphasis on the SEO side of it and less on the actual quality and experience of the read. And I do think, especially with the advent of, you know, data and such an emphasis on measurement for absolutely everything, it did mean that I do feel that because of that, it's keywords first and then just build a story around the keywords. And that then really takes away from the quality and the enjoyment of the read. So you need to find that balance.
And I think with the end of third party cookies having a big effect for many marketing departments, we're going to see that return to a focus on quality content over a sort of SEO driven, data driven approaches when it comes to content. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up at the end. Definitely, Andrea, thank you very much. And thank you for taking the time to speak to me again today. Really, really interesting conversation. Really, really interesting stuff. I think our audience is going to lap it up. And I hope they've enjoyed listening to us as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Will. A pleasure as always.
Yeah, we'll be back soon with another CMO Diary. Thank you again, Andrea.